Oh, if you're taking up too much space and carrying on, like a little snogging is cute, a moment is cute, but if like that's your destination for the night, like you're just in the way, just be no, you need to carry on over there in the corner, get out of the way because the dance floor is for dancing on some serious dancing tip. Now, I'm all for the romance and being in the heat of the moment. It's lovely, it's cool, but it cannot become like that's the thing that you're doing all night and just taking up all the room.
Hello, I am Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories they created there, and the people that they used to know. Today's guest is Ultra Nate, the dance music superstar best known for the 90s classic Free. A native of Baltimore, Maryland, Ultra fell into club culture in her first year of university. From here, she met the production duo The Basement Boys, started writing songs with them, and, well, yeah, the rest is history. This is really an episode about a number of venues: Odell's, Club Fantasy, and Paradox, with the common thread being the pioneering owner, Wayne Davis. Whilst none of these venues were queer, they did host specific nights promoted to this community, and being dance venues, the audience they attracted was really diverse. Ultra and I discuss the Baltimore house sound, being famous in one country and completely unknown in another, and the etiquette of snogging on the dance floor.
I mean, I was just a club kid, just a kid that stayed in the club as often as I could get there. Yes, every single weekend, every night of the weekend, if I could. You know, I wasn't a bad kid. I wasn't into like all kinds of craziness. I wasn't into drugs and all of that, or, you know, that culture. But I was around the culture and, you know, it was like, that's your thing. That's what you do. But, you know, I got to go dance. And that's really all I wanted to do was dance, like psychotic, is just be in the music, be immersed in that sound, you know, very Pisces. I needed to be immersed. And it just gave me everything that I didn't even know I needed. And I fell in love with it. It was just intoxicating.
So just a quick sidebar. When you're on the dance floor and dancing all night long, how sweaty do you get?
Oh, clearly, like, you know, drenched, like, you know, you're not doing anything if you're not coming out of there, you know, just like a wet noodle. Definitely. I mean, it's to the point, like, with our crews, like, people carry a second set of clothing to wear, you know, to wear later, to change into maybe in the course of the night, you know, you have your little freshen up kind of things, wipes and things with you to, like, you know, freshen up and change into a whole other outfit. That, you know, because these are long nights and it's a long morning. So, you know, and then sometimes you're going to breakfast and hanging out with friends after the club, you know, it's not over when it's over. So, you know, you got to be prepared for these things. You know, the better club kids are ready.
Well, I mean, that is very prepared. I always felt like I was the sweatiest person on the dance floor, and that there were some people who just, like, even if they were going at it really, really hard and dancing a lot, just maybe glistened. Maybe like there was a little bit of moisture. And I just want to know what their secrets are.
Well, I don't know. I was somewhere probably in the glistening, somewhere between glistening and a you know, wet rat. It depends on a lot of, you know, elements, how hot the club is, how packed the club is, how well the ventilation is. But I've never been scared of sweat. Like, I have no problem with it. I feel it's a very healthy thing to do. It means, you know, your systems are working correctly and you're detoxing. So, you know, when I look at it from that standpoint, it's like, great. I'm good.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I'm for it.
Some people are getting Botox in their underarms to prevent sweating.
That's true.
But then doesn't your sweat just go elsewhere?
I don't know, but we're going to have to look into that a little bit. It sounds a little stifling, like you're not detoxifying like you're supposed to, because that's how the body excretes toxins, is through the pores and through sweat. So I don't know, but there are people that sweat profusely, and so it can be a problem because it's a little over the top in terms of how much. So I can imagine over time that being kind of embarrassing, or just, you know, just a pain in the ass to deal with.
Yeah, you've either got to really lean into it or do something about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the way you were just talking about people and sweating has brought us to the fact that you were studying medicine when you started. That's the segue.
That was my intention.
Trying to make the segue here. Trying to make it work.
That was my intention. After high school, my high school curriculum was geared towards the medical profession. So I was taking, prerequisite courses for university while I was still in high school, and everything was geared towards the medical profession. So I had a lot of biology and anatomy, physiology, and chemistry, and all of those like really fun sciences. And then, you know, I graduated, I started at university, and then I fell into club culture, and it was just like, wow, this is amazing. And this is a whole other thing that opened up a whole other area of interest and exploration for me. So, you know, it wasn't by design on my part that I ended up in the music industry. I ended up in club culture. But being in club culture, I made connections with people who were, you know, just kind of starting to get their chops with the Basement Boys. Mainly with Tommy Davis from Basement Boys, because he was like one of the main DJs that worked at the record store where everyone went after the clubs were over, and they went to get the records that the DJ played that night that killed it on the dance floor. So he was kind of like, you know, this Pied Piper that was, you know, directing the sound and the culture in that way. And so I met Tommy through that situation, and he invited me actually to come down and meet the Basement Boys and just, you know, audition for them. And it was very casual. There was no grand, like, and this is what we're going to do, and it's going to be a thing. Like, it all came together really organically from that.
And so, like, that first time that you met, was it like, oh, we've been working on these beats, or we've been doing this, do you want to see if you can vibe with that? Or did it start from scratch?
Kind of like that, but definitely from scratch. The first time I went down, it was just the kind of the audition, and I just sang a cappella. So I sang Angela Winbush's Angel a cappella. And there were other established singers there, because I wasn't a singer in that way. I knew I could carry a tune, but I didn't consider myself a singer, and I had definitely never written a song before at that point. So these other people, they also auditioned. I was the only one out of the people that came that evening that they ended up actually working with. And I think because my vocal style was, I had this really raspy, kind of bluesy, jazzy quality to my vocal style, which I didn't realize was a style at the time. And when I actually wrote a song, which was It's Over Now, my first single that went on to become a top 20 chart hit in the UK, we did that organically, just hanging out in the basement and sitting around the table, and decided to, like, you know, come up with a song idea. And so we just pitched in all these ideas of what we wanted to talk about. I knew what I wanted to talk about, and it was organic as well, that I had like just broken up with like my first real boyfriend at that time. And so that was something to like talk about, like, it's over now, you know, and what that whole experience was like. And so this is coming from a very kid place in these first experiences. And then the boys were like, okay, you've got these lyrics. So, you know, let's see if you can put it to a track. And they did literally go into a closet and pull out a DAT at that time. You know, things were on DATs. So they pulled out a DAT with some beats, some random beats that they had put together, because they would just be in there all the time making beats. And they were like, okay, just go in there and sing it to this track. And I didn't even hear the track before. I was like, can I go home tonight and like maybe, you know, figure out like a vibe or something? Like, I don't even know what I'm walking into here, and I've never done this before. But they were like, oh, it's fine. You know, it's all very loose. So I went in the booth, and the track started with this back beat, you know, this jazzy kind of styling with this backbeat. And it was all very underground, very like, you know, underground house. It was just very organic and raw. And so I had these lyrics and I just kind of bounced off the rhythm and came up with, don't change my hair, the clothes I wear, life I live, love I give, and just started adding lyrics and bits and pieces. And I just found the rhythm pocket and developed a melody out of it and pieced together the lyrics to make my verses on the fly. All of it was on the fly. And that became the song. Like, they wouldn't let me record it again. The label wouldn't even let me record it again. It was crazy.
Like, sometimes there's that thing, like, because you were saying you weren't like a trained singer and you didn't consider yourself a singer. Sometimes that can be really helpful because you're not overthinking it and you're not kind of like.
That was the thing. That's what they said. Like, that was the magic. They were like, it's raw. The emotion is like right up front in your face. It's got its own style and attitude and energy. And it was like nothing else that was happening in house music or garage, as they called it at the time, or the UK called it garage. We just called it house. You know, there was nothing like that at the time in what was happening, because it was all, most of it was R&B tracks that were danceable being played in the club. And then what was coming up as house was what was being formulated out of Chicago and New York of, you know, just like the Basement Boys, young, new, would-be producers taking advantage of the new technology with a four track and making beats and writing these songs with vocalists, songwriters or whatever, and just like doing it in your basement. It was all very underground and loosely pulled together. And we were creating this whole genre, unbeknownst to ourselves. We were creating this genre that became the template and the foundation for what global dance music has become. Now.
And so you said before that the label wouldn't let you redo the vocals, that the boys wouldn't let you redo the vocals. Did you ask?
Oh, no. I did, because I kept fighting for it. And I was like, I just need to, just let me get at that one more time, you know, because I had no idea before when I was laying this stuff down, like there was any kind of thing going to come out of this. And all I could hear were, oh, that part sounds weird, or that's pitchy over there, or this, you know, all I could hear was like in my mind were errors and mistakes and things like that, because I'm like going off the top of my head with lyrics that I've never seen before that I just kind of wrote that didn't have any real structure. And I'm also doing it to a track that I've never heard. So like everything is completely organic and I wanted to do it again. So they finally acquiesced and let me do it again. And of course, I ironed out all of the areas that were like weird to me and pitchy or just off as in terms of what I knew and understood to be pitchy at that time, because, you know, I didn't clearly define those terms either at that point. But they said it was too clean the second time I did it. It was too precise, too clean, too perfected, and it lost the character. So those things that I interpreted as flaws were part of the character and the nuances that gave the song such distinction that's what people fell in love with, because it was raw and real in a real way. And that's what connected with people. And so they were like, okay, girl, you had your moment. Now we're going to put this original demo version out here in the world and you go about your business and promote it. Bye-bye.
So really they just set up that second session just to patronize you and placate you.
They did. They were like, okay, she's really wearing us out about this. Let's give her a bone.
All right, yeah, here we go. I'll press record. Off you go.
Give her a bone, you know. And everybody was like, okay, we'll give it a shot. But when they heard it, everybody was like, no, it's too perfect. It doesn't have that thing. It needs that thing, the sauce. And, you know, over the years, I've kind of understand what that was, what the sauce is, you know.
It's funny, isn't it? Sometimes, like, as an artist, that's a horrible way to start a sentence. As an artist, sometimes you have to, like, you have to listen to your gut. And sometimes you just have to listen to what other people are telling you. And it's really hard to know.
You got to find the sweet spot.
Yeah.
You got to find the sweet spot, because especially at that moment in my life, you know, I'm on a major record label. I'm on Warner Brothers. So I'm like, I'm just a kid. Like, I was going over here to university to study medicine. Like, you know, I don't know, all I have is my gut, but, you know, I'm going to take everyone's opinions in this, you know, as a valid opinion and weigh all of these things. So the consideration was absolutely there. And with that, I was like, well, let me just try it once. We never know. We never know, you know. And when it came back and everybody felt like, no, it's too clean, I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm good. Let's hit it. You like it? I love it.
Yeah. I mean, if they're fronting the bills as well.
Yeah. I mean, they knew. I mean, they knew what was going to work for them. And, you know, they're a major label putting this music out. So I don't think they're spending, you know, a ton of money, you know, investing in a completely unknown artist on something that, you know, they didn't feel that they were going to recuperate. You know, they're not in it for the love, and they're certainly not in it to be your best friend. They're in it because it's a business and you're a product and you have something that they can sell.
Mm-hmm. Which is like sometimes a useful way of looking at it and sometimes horrible way of looking at it, isn't it?
It's just facts. Well, and maybe because I've been doing it for 30 plus years, like I'm very clear about that. Like, you know, the rose colored shades came off a long time ago. Yeah, this is what it is.
So in terms of like where everything fits, so did you meet the Basement Boys when Club Fantasy was still in existence?
Yes. And Fantasy, actually, Club Fantasy was like the first place I ever performed once I had made a record. Like that was where my first, very first gig ever was at Club Fantasy on a Sunday night on Basement Boys night. And Teddy Douglas and Tommy would play, and they would, you know, play a lot of their new, you know, unreleased stuff. And it was just like their night to just be experimental and do things like just do their vibe. So that was my first gig. It's Over Now had come out, and I had to perform at Club Fantasy. It was the first time, and it was really fun. Like it went by so fast, and I still clearly remember the moment. How about that?
Okay, so but the moment before, were you just like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go and perform, or were you shitting yourself?
No, you know, I wasn't shitting myself. Only because I don't know. I think I've always kind of had a natural affinity for performing in a way. In a way, early in my career, I always preferred being live as opposed to being in the studio because I felt the studio was more intimidating and stressful because everything needed to be so specific and precise. And I feel like when you're live, because the energy is raw and everything happens organic, like your magic just happens naturally. Like that light switch comes on naturally without you having to turn it on like you have to do when you're in the studio. Like, okay, now I need to be great. It doesn't work like that. You know, you need to be inspired to be great. So I always preferred the live situation. So when that first show came up, and I had like this really great network of friends, my LGBTQ community friends, you know, they were awesome. And they just embraced, like, we have a show. You know, my show was, we have a show. So they got me together. You know, one did my makeup, they did my hair. One was an amazing hairstylist named Neil. And he was like the most amazing hairstylist in Baltimore City at the time. My friend Lyle made me this amazing tiny little Band-Aid size mini dress with these fabulous gloves with fringe hanging. It was all very diva, you know. Someone else did my makeup. I think Lyle actually did my makeup as well. And you know, they just like did me from head to toe. And
you weren't joking about this charmed existence, were you?
It was charmed. I'm telling you, I had all these great fairy god queens around me that just made it like fun. And it really, when you're a club kid, like you're already doing this anyway. Like it's all about the dress up. Like, what am I wearing to the club this weekend? Like that's all you cared about. You know, so this was just like the same energy, but on steroids. And now I'm going to be on stage in front of everyone and I've got to sing this song. And so I guess my natural energy whenever I get nervous to have to perform is I go inside. I go inside myself and then I push that energy out. And so that's basically what I did. So I just started off the show in this very epic kind of way of being in a pose and not moving, like the crowd was losing their mind and I was just like frozen, but it was for effect. And then the, you know, the track started with the saxophone and everybody's went, ah! You know, so it was amazing. Like, how can you not win when everyone is rooting for you. You know what I mean? This is my family. These are people that I hang out with every weekend, and they're all rooting for you. You know what? What an magnificent, you know, experience.
Most of the people I talk to, when I'm like, so what was your first performance like? They're like, oh God, I was
like, oh, everything was falling apart.
It was awful. The crowd was
no, dead-eyed. I've had those experiences later. No, that was later. There were those times later. But that first out the gate moment was really epic. And, you know, I really appreciate it. Like my Baltimore family, like, you know, I test so much stuff on their ears. And I still have through the year. The first time I ever performed free, to fast forward many, many years later, the first time I ever performed free shortly after I had recorded it, and it was still in a demo form, I performed it here in Baltimore at a little small club called The Spot. And it was just like heads, you know, and I just needed to hear it live. So I, you know, I tested on my folks, you know, and get their energy and reaction just to hear it out there in the universe coming back at me. And it's kind of like a feedback loop, you know?
And yeah, when there's that many people, they can't fake it, can they? Like, you're going to get that really honest feedback.
No, not at all. And Baltimore is a very particular kind of city because it's very like, you know, trash or no grab. Like, they will, if it's not hot, they're not going to fake it, you know? So it's like that old saying about New York, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. Well, Baltimore has that same kind of energy because they are very like cutthroat about things. So they either love it or hate it. And there are very few places in between.
I mean, you know where you stand at least. Can we talk a bit more about Baltimore? Like, I think like for people, sure. I mean, I don't really know that much about it other than John Waters is from there. Tori Amos is from there. You're mm-hmm. from there. Mm-hmm. But like in terms, yep. in terms
Billie
of
Holiday,
the city,
yeah, yeah.
like, you know, you talked about house evolving from Chicago and New York, and people are kind of used to hearing about those cities in relation to that scene. What is distinct about the Baltimore scene?
Well, I think it goes again to what I was saying about that kind of brash persona or energy about the city, because Baltimore is a blue collar city in its origins. It's a port city. So there are a lot of factories, there are a lot of building of ships and imports, exports, things going on from the city. So it's been very blue collar throughout much of its history. In recent years, obviously, it's evolved and developed and grown and is becoming more cosmopolitan. But those roots are still very ingrained in Baltimore culture. And so it's a very inclusive kind of city. So they embrace like the quirkiness, the weirdness, the bizarreness of a lot of people, which is why, you know, John Waters is kind of like a staple representation of Baltimore in a way, because that is a very specific culture in Baltimore that he embodies in that way. But, you know, it has its problems, as most inner city cities do, you know. But it's grown so much over the years and continually growing. And I just love it because it just kind of has that old school kind of charm where it's still just between that place of like, you know, being kind of in your face and gritty, but still growing and maturing and turning into like it's fuller realization of itself. And so, you know, I always root for the underdog, and Baltimore City is definitely an underdog, because most people only think of it from what they've seen in media, which has been things like The Wire and things like that. And that's definitely a reality and has been a reality for years, but it's not the complete story of what this city is about. And also for me, you know, having started very young in the music industry and traveling abroad immediately, it was always nice to come home to like this little kind of, you know, hamlet of a city and know, you know, the people and the energy of the place and be around things that you have memories attached to. So I've never necessarily felt the need like, oh, I've got to move somewhere. I've got to go somewhere else, because I've always had the luxury of being anywhere else in the world that I wanted to be at any given time anyway, and still be able to stay close to my roots and close to family and friends that have been, you know, a part of who I am for my whole life. So that's always been really important to me.
Yeah, because there's this thing like, so I've lived in London for a really long time, so I'm probably not the best person to talk about this, but in those smaller cities where it's maybe like a bit more affordable to live and it's not so cutthroat, then there is that kind of experimentation and there is that kind of space for people to try things over here and do this over here, because you're not going to bankrupt yourself by doing so. And it kind of brings out all these kind of cool, interesting ideas that might be complete failures, but is something different.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. So we're going all over the place. So we were at the point where you'd done your first performance. And so how did that feel coming off? And how did it feel like in the days after? Did you get the bug?
It was epic. It was epic coming off stage. It really was. It was epic because, you know, I felt like, well, for one, everyone was in love with this song and it already had such a great story and a great relationship with everyone. And like I said, again, everyone was rooting for me, you know, so it was easy to make them happy to this song that they had been hearing for months and months and months. You know, at that time, music lived in the charts a lot longer than they do now, you know, in the charts and on the dance floor. I think now you've got like this ridiculous 3-week window in the charts. Back then, with It's Over Now, it circulated for a year just as a demo on a reel before it even got signed. And then it was put out, you know, officially, and then they did its campaign and lifespan that way. So it had been around for a long minute by the time I had even gotten to that point. So everyone was like, the attachment to that was already well ingrained in everyone's head. So for me, it was really easy and it was like a natural high. And it was, you know, it was just a further extension of an art that I didn't know that I had, because I had in this process found out, oh, I can sing a little bit. Oh, cute. Oh, I can write songs too. This is fabulous. Oh, and I'm a performer, because not all the time, just because you sing or you write, are you a performer as well? That's a whole other discipline. But it was great to, like, you know, be learning all these amazing things about myself at the time. So yeah, I felt very gratified. It was a wonderful experience.
And so I didn't realize that the window was so long. So you met the boys, you'd started recording, and then so you were just kind of going about your life whilst the song was finding its own life.
Yeah, I didn't even believe that it was happening. I mean, before the label deal happened, like I said, the boys sent it to Tony Humphries. They had a relationship with Tony, and Tony was like the premier DJ in New Jersey with his club Zanzibar, but he was also the premier DJ for house music on Kiss FM in New York, and his show was aired on Kiss FM in London. So Tony was notorious for having all of these tracks from everyone in the underground who were making these songs, and, you know, he would be the only person to have it, and he wouldn't share it with anyone. So you had to tune into Tony's show. And, you know, there wasn't the thing of the rampant, you know, file sharing and burning and snatching music and all that kind of stuff like it is now. So, you know, he could play these records on the radio and play them at the club incessantly without someone, you know, ripping it and then putting it out and you lose the momentum on it. In fact, that just continued to build the momentum on all of this stuff. So, yeah, It's Over Now had a long lifespan just, you know, on the grassroots level, before it even became a signed record.
Isn't that incredible? The whole way the music industry is totally flipped upside down, the way that it works, and that, like, before you wanted it to be
flipped.
You wanted it
that
to be
word,
as rare
yes.
as possible to, like, build people's appetite. And now if people can't find it, like, the first ranking on the Google search, they're,
you're dead in the water.
About it.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yep. Dead in the water. Well, also, you know, people, you're able to put out so much music these days because of technology. You know, people are making music on the fly of 10 minutes, and then they're able to upload the track, and then it's on a digital website. So that's also, you know, become problematic because the music is saturated, the scene is saturated. Whereas that wasn't the case. Like, you know, this kind of song, it stood by itself. It was a thing unto itself. So of course, at the time, everyone was like, what is this song? I've got to have it. Oh my God, this is my song. Tony would literally play this song 3 times a night in the course of a night at Zanzibar. And that's when I really got it, because Tommy would tell me when I would come into the record store after, you know, a night of hanging out at the club here in Baltimore, not Fantasy, but by then we were at Odell's. And again, Wayne Davis was, you know, part of the Odell's into the Fantasy era, but Odell's was first. And that's where I initially connected with Tommy and Teddy and Jay. And then in that process over time, Wayne transitioned from Odell's to Start Club Fantasy, Basement Boy Night, my first performance, blah, blah, blah. And the song was signed by then. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about a year in the making of all of those things, before, from the time that I actually recorded the track to the time that it actually came out as a commercial single.
And so in that time, you just kind of continued at school and you were just like, man, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't believe any of it was happening. And Tommy, because you have to understand Tommy's energy, he's always really amped. And he's like, Miss Ultra Baby, he calls me Ultra Baby, Miss Ultra Baby, and they're killing it. And they're dancing to it three times a night. It's crazy. And like, his energy is already here all the time anyway. So I'm just like, Bushrod, my nickname for him is Bushrod. Like, what are you talking about? It cannot be that serious. Like, whatever. And until I actually went to Zanzibar, finally, and observed for myself the night I had to perform the song at Zanzibar. And literally, it was hands in the air, the whole club, every single time Tony played it. So it was really happening. It was really happening. And I was oblivious.
Yeah, that must have been a real trip. Like, because again, the difference between the industry then and now is that, like, everyone has all of the metrics immediately about how well the song's doing. So they
I know,
have all that information.
I had no clue. And until my label head folks called me when they, you know, when the deal was on the table, until the day that they called me while I was at work, I had a little baby job at the time as, cause I was going into medicine. So I had a little job as a physical therapy assistant to the assistant or something. And I was at work.
And they called the office.
And they called me. Yeah. Like Cynthia Cherry and Peter Edge. Like they called me while I was at work. And I was like, I'm on the phone with like Warner Brothers Records. Like, what is happening? You know what I mean? So it was all very surreal for me at the time. And then when I went to London and I went to Highland Hope and met Norman Jay, he was kind of basically the equivalent of a Tony Humphries on this side of the water. And so High on Hope was sort of the equivalent of what Zanzibar was. And it was just massive on both these fronts. And this record was just doing its thing. And it is what basically started my whole career.
And so what was the nature of that phone call? Were they like, you need to quit your job?
You're like, where is the problem in this story? The problems came later.
No. I'm not lining for trauma. I promise. Just like, you know, this is before mobile phones. So they've like looked up your work number and they've rung you.
Well, they got it from the boys. They didn't have to, but they got it from the boys, and they, you know, they called me at work and they just called me to say hello and to just chat. Like, they had never talked directly to me because they were talking to the boys because they were my producers. So I had a production deal with Basement Boys. So basically they were the intermediaries between me and the label themselves. But at this point, like everything was going down. So they wanted to reach out and have a conversation with me directly. And they still had never met me. They didn't meet me until months and months later when they flew to New York. And I went up to New York to Zanzibar as well to meet them there. So that's when we physically met in person.
Oh, and so you were signed without them having met you?
Correct.
Wow. Wow.
I know, it's all crazy when I talk about it out loud. Like, oh yeah, that is.
So they weren't like, that I mean, because you know, like again, you hear these horror stories about the industry and people being like, oh, you're not tall enough, your breasts aren't big enough, you're this, we're not going to sign you. Like, and they were just like, oh, hey, yeah, by the way, we're signing you.
No, I mean, I'm sure they had pictures of me, and the boys had shot like a little video of me. Like, we went to Fantasies one night and like I danced to It's Over Now. Like, I just like dancing because I was a dancer. I was just a kid, club kid. So I did what I always do every weekend. I just danced. And, you know, at that time, everything was, you know, the tracks were all like 11, 12 minutes long because that's the early days of house. So everything was an extended, you know, club mix. And so it was, you know, probably 11, 12 minutes of just me dancing by myself to this song. And that's what, they sent them. And then they were like, we're going to sign her.
Wait, like a single shot, or did they edit it?
Single shot, baby. There was no trickery going on at all. Like, this was like straight, raw, one shot, aim, fire, dance. Not great lighting.
How many takes did you do?
It's just one. You got one shot, babe. I know this all sounds crazy. It is crazy because things are so dramatically different now.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I danced every single weekend and I would be on stage dancing and hanging out and partying, and, you know, I wasn't nervous about the camera looking at me because I'm always in the club dancing anyway. So there's always people looking at you.
Well, yeah, but by the time you get to like minute seven, you must have been like, what can I do now?
Listen, this is underground club culture. It's underground club culture. We dance until the next day without a problem. Okay. So yeah, like that 12 minutes was absolutely nothing. It was just like, let's just, all right. They would just want to see how I dance. They want to see how I move. Okay. Then they started the track. And I just danced. Oh, and they still, those boys still have that damn tape somewhere. I'm sure someday it's going to surface and I'm going to be like,
yeah, when is it going on YouTube?
No, darling. No, darling.
I'll get in touch with them. I'll find
it. It is our, it's our personal little kiki. Like, we occasionally have dipped back to that and just had the massive falling out laugh about that moment. And now, you know, I was dancing, I was getting it done. You know, I was a club kid, so.
Do they threaten to leak it if you ever have a fight?
No, not at all. Not at all. Boys wouldn't do that. They don't want to deal with that wrath. They don't want that other girl on the other side. And they don't want that, no. But no, that was the audition tape, I guess, for lack of a better excuse. That was the audition. Like, they just wanted to see what I looked like and see how I moved. And they sent them that video recording. And then they were like, okay, here's the record deal.
Just done, and done. There you go. Off you go. Easy, simple. So the other thing that I often ask my guests is, did they snog anyone in the club?
Well, you just were not in the club if you haven't snogged someone in the club. Of course.
Like,
the
club is a perfect
place. Well, when you say snogging, I'm talking about kissing them. You're talking about anything further than that.
No, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, from my British interpretation, it's just kissing. Of course, yes. Like, that's epic. Are you kidding me? What? I'd do it now. Can we go out? Like, really? Yes. Don't let me be in the club with someone I'm attracted to. It's so going down. There will be kissing.
Oh. Yeah. So what? Oh. So are you like, do you just pursue?
Do I what? Say it again. What was the question?
I didn't say anything rude, I promise. Do you pursue? Are you the pursuer?
Oh, do I pursue? No. No. I mean, I'm not for like not letting someone know if I'm not interested in them. If I'm interested in them, I have no problem in letting them know that. But I'm very much a Pisces Aries girl. So you need to let me know. And you need to come through because I have a very strong personality. So, you know, I don't want to feel like he's not in this and I'm running around like after him. Like, what is that about? I'm still about like, you need to come through with like some serious energy and let me know what's up. And if I'm, you know, into you, then I will return that.
Okay. So like, let's just say you're hitting on me. Well, like, you know, you're making it... You're making it obvious to me.
I give you a little flirty moment. Okay.
Yeah. So how does that work?
This is so specific. It's not that specific. I don't know. I mean, it could just be like, you know, things happen organically when you're in the club. Like, you know, there could be a moment where there's a song that comes on and you're both vibing at that moment and you start dancing together. Like, that can like make a connection, or somewhere in a conversation. I mean, you can read body language and how someone looks at you, how someone puts themselves in your space. Like, you know, there's things that people can do. Now, that first moment is not going to end up in a snog. That only is going down with someone that I am dealing with. But yeah, you know, I don't know how to explain. This is so specific.
Okay. But so, like, so when you're talking about being sweaty on the dance floor, are you pro or not pro? What's the opposite? What's the word I'm looking for? Pro or against? Pro or against? People who like properly make out on the dance floor.
Oh, if you're taking up too much space and carrying on, like a little snogging is cute, a moment is cute, but if like that's your destination for the night, like you're just in the way, just be, no, you need to carry on over there in the corner, get out of the way, because the dance floor is for dancing on some serious dancing tip. Now, I'm all for the romance and being in the heat of the moment. It's lovely. It's cool. But it cannot become like that's the thing that you're doing all night and just taking up all the room.
I totally, totally agree. And I hate when people are just like not moving with the crowd and they're just like blocking everyone's.
Oh, no. That will get you in big trouble around here. Big trouble.
But have you ever done it?
No. There's dance floor etiquette.
But it is kind of fun. I don't want anyone else to do it, but like if I'm doing it, it's kind of fun.
To what? Just stand there in the middle of the floor and make out just, for like endless time?
But like, you know that like ridiculous making out that you do in a club, like where it's just like, ah. Okay, this puzzled look. I maybe just need to give up this.
I'm not doing the like the ridiculous, crazy, out of control make out. Like that's not gonna get, it's not gonna get that off the chain. Only because I don't have any privacy, like when I'm in the club, like everybody's looking. So, you know, it's going to be, it can be hot, but it can't be like, get a room, guys, seriously, like really? I don't need to be an exhibitionist for the sake of being, you know, of being an exhibitionist, but I'm on stage all the damn time. Like, I know where to get my attention. That's not. So if you see me in that kind of move, it's going to be like, I'm really in that moment, but it's not going to be super extra because I don't need everybody in my bedroom game. So yeah, you know, it can happen, but within measure.
Okay. Well, now you've just made me seem even sluttier than I do in every episode. Thanks.
Oh, you're messy. You're messy.
It doesn't happen very often. And, you know, obviously it's not happened for a very long time, but it's just that like,
you were in the moment and you know, there was the right song, the lights, the music, you know, you just kind of lost yourself in the moment and I'm here for it. I'm
just don't be anywhere near you when it happens,
you know, but that's really, you know, how it happens.
I would just kind of elbow you whilst I was dancing. So you would like get annoyed and leave the dance floor. That's all I would do.
I would give you space, child. They're in their own world. Love is grand. Love is grand when it works, honey. Get it. Get all of it. Get all of it.
Oh, again, you're looking like a nicer person than me.
Get all of it, unless I'm really like in deeply in a dance and in my space, and you come up in my space and just decide to stop in my space with the shenanigans. We're gonna have
that
problems.
I mean, some people just no manners.
Just saying.
So let's get to Paradox, because we have waffled about lots of other things. So you'd already had your success in the UK by the time Paradox opened.
Right.
And so do you remember like the first time you ever went there?
Oh yeah. So, you know, I'm deep in my culture here. So yeah, I was part of the initial family. I mean, I watched the club be built around us. The same with Fantasy, you know, knocking out walls, adding a wall. You come one week, the wall is over here. The next week, the booth is over there. Like, yeah, that was all part of the process. So it was basically the same thing. Like every weekend, it was a cash infusion and Wayne would invest it in the club. And that's what he always did, just reinvest as the club was open and it's really raw, in its rawest kind of, you know, representation. Every week you put the money back in the club or in the sound system and continue building things up around you. So I was at Paradox, which was a 13,000 square foot warehouse when it was concrete floors. And I'm sure my joints in my back don't appreciate those years that I was stomping around up in there, you know, endlessly for hours. But, you know, I watched the club grow and be built and come to this, you know, amazing venue that it ended up being for 27 years.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about Wayne. So was Paradox opened simply because Club Fantasy, the audience outgrew the venue?
No, not because the audience outgrew the venue. The city had decided where Fantasy was located was now going to be a route for a new metro system.
Ah, okay.
And it was going to be straight in the front door on the street of where Club Fantasy was. Because Fantasy was, it was a three-story townhouse and made into a club venue. And so it was still like right in the middle, in the heart of the city of downtown. And that area still had some local residents directly around the corners. So it was kind of in a tricky location anyway. And the city decided to start building up into that part of downtown and put this metro system there. So he had to move from that. You know, they sorted him out. They came to some kind of deal or whatever understanding. And then he took that investment and started with this extremely raw space, again, of Paradox, which was just this shell of a warehouse.
And so that first time then, it was like a celebration.
It was definitely a celebration because, you know, we were a loyal crew of people. Like everybody here houses, like, you know, from the soul for us in Baltimore in that way, the same way it was for Chicago and New York. You know, Baltimore sound was very relevant. It just had a bit more, you know, floor to floor stomp to it. It had a little more gospel intonation. It had a little bit of like Miami kind of, you know, breakbeats and some components of it. And, but those that were in it were really about that life. Like it was really a very strong culture here. So we would follow Wayne like the Pied Piper, no matter what.
Oh, that's incredible.
So yeah, we were all very emotionally vested in whatever Paradox was going to be because we had followed Wayne from O'Dell's, which was the inception of all things house in this city. I mean, he brought to us, you know, from the Richard Long sound system culture, that analog sound of Paradise Garage. He built that culture here in this city. And so from O'Dell's, then into Fantasy and onto Paradox. So he had, you know, the whole culture behind him. And even when he started Paradox, actually, he had the both sides of the culture, because not only did he have the underground house kids, he also had the Baltimore club kids, which is a slightly different take on the house scene. It's a whole different thing that's origins are strictly from Baltimore. But then he also had the rave scene starting there as well. And that's part of what made like the rave scene on the East Coast culture like massive was clubs like Paradox.
Just fostering that. One of the things that I wanted to ask was around So you'd been signed in the UK, you'd released like records in the UK mm-hmm. that had more mainstream success mm-hmm. than in the US. So it's kind of like, mm-hmm. so the question yes. that I'm leading to is like, what is that like when you're famous in one country and not famous in the country that you're from?
It's like living in two worlds. But it was okay for me, and it's still okay for me actually, because that's still really my reality. You know, it's fine because, you know, I'm very Pisces, like a swim upstream and downstream at the same time. I enjoy a certain bit of anonymity just so I can just relax and not have to worry about, like, what do my lashes look like? Is the lighting okay? Am I at a good angle? You know, like, who wants to deal with that all the time? I often you know, feel bad for artists that are kind of at that level, because although it looks all very glamorous and fabulous to be that famous, there's a certain level of freedom that's taken away from you because you have to meet
it's really constricting, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to meet this level of expectation for people all the time. And that's a lot of stress to deal with. So I actually enjoyed that freedom of being able to like, okay, when I need to turn this on, I just jump on a plane and I go to Europe or London, UK, wherever. And then I am a thing when I want to be a thing. But when I want to come home and just chill and just be ultra under normal circumstances and not worry about my hair or my eye makeup or any of that, and just like kick it with my people and be silly and stupid and whatever, and nobody's judging that, like I felt like I had, again, like the best of both worlds, because I could go to the UK and my face is on buses and posters and things like that across the city and in magazines. And then I would come home and, you know, go grocery shopping amongst everyone and no one has a clue.
So you hadn't developed a diva personality. You weren't like storming through the doors of Paradox and demanding the VIP treatment.
No, but that was expected anyway. Let's get it. No, it's a matter of respect. I mean, you know, it is a small city, so everybody knows, you know, who you are, what you do. And so there is a level of expectation with that. But at the same time, a lot of them are my friends, and a lot of them are crew that I've known for years. And a lot of people are people that I've known before a career even happened. And those dynamics haven't changed. But they also understand that I'm a thing that is kind of different from just, you know, who we are in our regular kind of situation. And when I have to be out and be another thing for what my audience expects. So all of my friends who've been with me, they get that. And so they're good. We're all good with it.
Yeah. It's that thing that you were talking about before. And like there's ultra the person and ultra the product. And it's healthy to look at them as distinct things. So Paradox.
Yes.
Was really celebrated as just being this type of venue where there were all kinds of people. So, the only distinction I'm about to make is straight and gay. But like, can you talk to me about like the crowd there and who was going and who was dancing beside you?
I mean, everybody was going, everybody and anybody. And it, you know, it was a place of acceptance. So you could come in like your weird state and in your crazy outfit and experiment and have fun. And there's, it's kind of like no judgment, because the wilder and crazier it was, you know, the better. You know, it's a completely freeing kind of atmosphere. And, you know, when if someone was there who had that kind of energy, like they were judging people, well, then you were kind of the odd man out. Like, well, what's your problem? Like, this isn't the space for you, because we're not doing that here. Everybody here is in this together, gay, straight, black, white, old, young, you know, we're not divided by any of those kind of barriers. Like, it was literally a melting pot of people and energies, and everyone kind of fed off of each other's differences. Like, that's what made it really, really special, is those differences were celebrated as opposed to looking, you know, being frowned upon in a way.
And I'm really interested in like how certain clubs cultivate that culture, and whether it's the architecture, whether it's just the people that happen to live in that city, or whether it's the kind of the curation of the owner, or whether it's a combination of everything. Like, do you know kind of what the secret ingredients were to make Paradox that special place?
It was definitely the curation of the owner, because he made it intentionally a place, a welcoming space for creative culture, for dance music culture in all its forms. So it you know, everything starts at the top, at the head. So Wayne being the head, he set the template of what the club's story and energy would be. And then from there, the music, as he always said, the music dictates the crowd. And so the music was inclusive, and the community that was promoted to was, you know, multicultural. I know for me, doing the Deep Sugar parties, one of the biggest things that we've always put forward is to make sure that we cross promote to all different kinds of people, because it has always garnered like this really great inclusive vibe. And so many people have come away from it saying, wow, I haven't been to an event like that before, where there's so many different kinds of people just all like on this same vibe, on the same wavelength, enjoying this music and just in this place spiritually together. You know, and so that was learned from what Wayne had created. And that was what Paradox facilitated, is that mm-hmm. inclusivity.
And so the club opened in 91 and had a really, mm-hmm. really good run. It lasted for like 26 years before closing in 2017. And was like really just there for your whole, you know, whole adult life.
I know. Yeah.
What happened when you found out that it was closing? How did you respond?
I was heartbroken. I mean, we were heartbroken for like the last 3 years of it. We just were in a state of heartbroken. But, you know, we knew inevitably the day was coming. You know, Wayne was getting older. It was a lot of work on him to sustain the club. I was on the road and had, have my career, so I couldn't step into his shoes in order to, you know, keep it running myself in that way, that kind of management level. And he really didn't have anyone around that he felt would really be able to sustain it and keep it going in that way. And then, you know, the decision was made beyond us anyway. And the city had developers had come in and bought property around the club. And the owner of the venue, because Wayne wasn't the owner. He owned the business, yeah. Paradox, but he didn't own the building. And so the owner of the building had did a deal with the developers and basically sold the building anyway. So it became part of a larger plan that is now under construction to develop an entertainment complex that's going to be a lot more, I would imagine, more commercial when it, you know, finally sees the light of day. But it's been in progress for the last 3 years. So those last few years, we mourned the club heavily, but we threw a lot of really great parties. And we made sure we sent her off, you know, with some epic vibes. Mm.
And so that very, very last night, tell me what happened.
Well, we had a marathon, like a crazy marathon. We had had two marathons because we kept getting false starts from the developers when we needed to close. And so we were like, okay, this is it. And then we have this end of the party. And then it's like, but wait, there's more. So that kind of kept happening because their timeline kept getting pushed back. So while their timeline for, you know, demolishing the building kept getting pushed back, the owner of the building was like, well, Wayne, you may as well just, you know, keep going for now and, you know, enjoy the club while we still have it. So we would be like, okay, we're still going. So it kind of happened a lot. And we had a lot of time to mourn it because all of that was in play for over a year. So, you know, I would just have these nights of, and Lisa and I, and at any given moment, anybody on the Paradox and Deep Sugar team could just go in and have an emotional breakdown, like at any given time. It was just like, that was just the order of the day on any given weekend, at any given moment, somebody's going to get hit with that reality that this is going to be gone. Our home is going to be gone. At some point, and you look around the room and you look at these people and you look and you hear this incredible system and you feel it in your body and you're like, this is all going to be gone in a minute. And there's nothing else like it to replace this moment. And there are people coming behind me who will never be able to experience this. This is genre defining. This has brought couples together, and this has facilitated the birth of children, and this has launched careers and, you know, created friendship, lifelong friendships. And, you know, there's so much history in these walls. It's not just a building, it's a whole life experience. And so to see that coming to an end and to know that there's nothing even close that can touch it. Like, you have to try to take all of that in and process it and then find some place to make peace with it. And so that was the work that we were doing for like the last, you know, 2 years of the docs. When that final night came, you know, nobody wanted to leave. Exhausted as we were, you know, I probably had like 5 changes of clothes. I lived in the club the whole weekend and no one wanted to go home. And people would leave because they were exhausted and they would go home and take a cat nap. And they would be right back at the club because nobody wanted to approach that moment when it was officially the last dance.
Did you ever go to Odell's Club Fantasy or Paradox? Well, if you did, I would love to hear from you. Find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook with the username KAndersonMusic and tell me what you got up to. Share any photos and just tell me how it was there. And whilst you're at it, go and give Ultra some love on Instagram. You can find her with the username Ultra Nate Music. Lost Spaces is not only a podcast, but a concept record as well. I've been writing songs about queer venues and the people who used to live their lives there, and we'll be releasing songs over the coming year. You can hear the first single, which is called Well Grown Boys, and is also playing underneath my talking right now, on all good streaming platforms. If you liked this episode, I would really appreciate if you subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or just tell people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. I am Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.